If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56diva.com. Lower.com, equal housing lender, MLS 112-4061.
He is not my discovery, but I have... He is now close to my heart and head and everything else. His name is Barry, B-A-R-R-Y, Pierce. Barry, because he's Irish and has a strange, well, I'm half Irish, and my mother changed her name about four different times to various things. Barry, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rick. Great to be here.
This book is a collection of short stories. It is titled The Plan of Chicago. Talk to me first about the title.
Well, the official plan of Chicago, of course, is Daniel Burnham's 1909 plan, which is a kind of foundational document. One of the things that started modern urban planning. So there's that idea of how the city gets carved up and planned. And then, you know, it's sort of ironic in the book because, as one reviewer said, not much goes according to plan in the plan of Chicago. So I was thinking of Burnham's sort of ideal, sort of almost Garden of Eden kind of vision of what the city could be, which is fairly unrealistic. And then the way the city's actually planned, which, you know, includes a lot of racial divisions, ethnic divisions, class divisions, all those kinds of things that keep us apart as a city.
Your parents came here from Ireland, yes?
They did.
Did they come alone? Were they – I know you – you're one of seven children?
I'm one of seven,
the
yeah.
Middle of seven.
In the middle of seven. It's why I'm so even-keeled and well-tempered. My oldest brother...
Like most Irish
people. Right,
yes,
exactly. Yeah. My oldest brother was born there, and so he came. He was probably two, I think, when they came here. And, of course, they came to relatives. That's why they wound up in Chicago.
Sure.
They always wanted to go to California, which cracks me up now because...
Why?
Why?
It's sunny. They
you
wanted
know,
to be in
yeah,
movies.
You see yeah. movie stars and you watch movies and you think America, California. But
and they wound up moving to South Shore?
They came to South Shore first, and I had
To do what? What did they do when they got here?
My dad was a carpenter, and so, you know, he came over with like a bag of tools and a change of clothes first on his own. Got a job, worked for a little while, and then brought my mom over. Kind of same old story. And they were all in a tiny apartment. Typical sort of, you know, immigrant get your bearings,
sure.
get your feet under you kind of thing, and until they went out on their own.
And then you moved, and then you started. Then they started having more children.
They kept having kids, yes.
And they didn't care how many
good
of you
Catholics
were in each
that they
bedroom.
Were.
Yeah, you had two bedrooms.
I shared a bedroom. Yeah. My house growing up was initially two bedrooms.
Yeah.
We added a third later, but it was me and three brothers, two sets of bunk beds in the one room. It was not a big room
wow.
either.
Wow. What were some of your first, Barry, if you remember them? The book is infused, I think, with a real, not just an understanding of Chicago, but a real affection for Chicago, for its many joys and many non-delights. You remember when you first started falling? You're of an age when you could just, you and your brothers and... Depends how evil they were, could just wander, could wander the city and have the kind of adventures that I don't think kids are allowed to have.
Yeah, we've talked about it before. We sort of had the keys to the city, and you were sent out in the morning, and, you know, you just didn't come home. So I remember wandering. In fact, even before I was allowed to, I mean, at a very young age, I got in trouble for wandering off all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I just was really compelled by what's on the next block, what's in the next neighborhood.
Now, when you were young, let's say 5 years old, well, you went to grammar school, obviously, as did your brothers. Where'd you all go?
Grimes, Robert L. Grimes, mm-hmm. on the southwest side, right next to Midway Airport over there, still going strong.
And at what point, you know, I know in reading your little biographical information spices this book that you're the first member of your family to go to college.
That's right, yeah.
How'd that happen? What did your three older brothers decide to do with their lives?
Well, my two oldest brothers dropped out of high school, were in and out of trouble, but became tradesmen, both became mm-hmm. painters, not mm-hmm. fine art, not canvas, houses. And my next brother did make it through high school, became a cabinet maker. The high school they went to near us was not great.
Which one?
And Kennedy High School.
Yeah.
You know, it was going through a lot of problems at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe better now, but So they didn't have a great time there. And so I did pretty well in grade school. I got good grades, and they thought maybe we'll invest and send this guy to a Catholic high school. So I went to St. Lawrence.
You went to St. Lawrence.
And I think my dad was really annoyed later because then all three of my sisters after me went to Catholic high schools. So he had four Catholic high school tuitions at one point.
Ouch.
All at the same time.
And where'd the girls go?
They went to Maria.
Okay. Either Maria or Macaulay.
Those are the options. Yeah, Lourdes.
When then, Barry, did writing... You know, it sounds like you might have had the kind of home that was not filled with books. I mean, you're all tradesmen. Yeah. Your father is. when did writing enter your life, the writing of other people?
Yeah, I just was always semi-good at it and drawn to it and loved – we used to have these little book fairs at school, which were usually terrible books. They would be like books written based on the movie, like
sure.
Herbie the Love Bug and
yeah,
things
sure.
like that. But even those, I just remember.
Literature.
I loved those little book fairs, and I would come home with, you know, three, four, or five books. And I can't, it's not something I can easily explain. Like,
yeah.
None of my brothers were into it. One of my brothers, Colm, who passed away not long ago, said to me once, I can't imagine how you could just sit there and read a book. You know, like,
yeah.
he just didn't get it. He was a doer and a mover, and he didn't want to be sitting down reading. So I don't know why that gene wound up in me or where it comes from.
But then the spark, Barry, it's difficult to think of yourself, I think it is, as a writer if you're not in an environment where at least somebody else isn't writing, you know? Was there a teacher at St. Lawrence who
I didn't have
inspired you.
Yeah, I didn't have too many role models in the neighborhood as far as writers go. But yeah, at Lawrence, I remember I had two English teachers in particular, Mr. Kroc, and Mr. Lynch, who were both great teachers. And I do remember like the one time in a class turning in a paper about Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and the teacher saying to the class, you know, holding up my paper and saying, this is really good. If you guys get a chance, you should read this.
Wow.
And I thought, well, that's weird. Like, you turn in writing to get a grade. It's not something you would give to your peers to read.
It's not like being an actor getting on a stage.
So it was a watershed moment a little bit. You know, made me think of it differently, for sure.
And when you're getting ready to graduate and you're getting ready to pursue, and I'm sure you talk to your dad and say, you must say, can we afford to send me to college?
Yeah, I think they were really pleased and overjoyed that I would go to college or that I could get in,
sure.
and they thought that was cool. They, you know, they didn't go to college,
right?
Didn't know anyone in the neighborhood who went to college, but I think my dad, you know, then I majored in journalism because that's where the big money is.
Yeah, tell me about
right.
Why journalism? Let's talk about that then.
Well,
Was your house? Did your parents subscribe to newspapers?
They did. I'm sorry, Rick. The Sun Times.
Sorry. I've worked for all of them.
That's true.
All I can say too is the good old days.
Yeah.
What'd they read?
They read the Sun. You know, the working man's paper on the South Side. The Sun Times. Cover to cover. My dad would read it cover to cover and then say, "There's nothing in that thing," and he would throw it on the table, which always cracked me up because he'd just finish it. I just thought, I mean, I probably would have been a English major or a creative writing major, except I did have that working class idea, like you need a job when you get out of college.
I get it.
Journalism seemed like a way to get a job.
Very interesting.
It was true. It did get me a job. Not a good job, but it did get me a job.
We are talking this entire hour and perhaps more on the glorious return of Rick Cogan to the airwaves on WGN. Thanks to Dan Long in there and Tony DeNardis for reminding me how this thing is done. We're talking for this whole hour and maybe more with Barry Pierce, Southsider, St. Lawrence. They read his teacher told everybody to read his story about Virginia Woolf, and that got him to go to Northwestern. Was it hard to get into Northwestern? You were going there. You weren't going directly to McGill.
I did go directly to McGill. I think in those days, I don't know if it's different now, I think you have to apply to McGill, you know? So, and they're, I think they had a lower acceptance rate maybe than the overall one at the university.
Did you have, you know, I know you got the Sun-Times at home, but did you know any journalists when you were 17? That's before Watergate. Yeah. Or around Watergate time. I mean, did you?
Yeah, it would have been after Watergate for me.
Yeah, okay.
I knew that legendary story and of those guys. But I didn't know. No, I worked on the high school yearbook, was the closest I came to.
Yeah.
I became the editor of the yearbook.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when I was a late junior, probably maybe even senior year, a guidance counselor, I told him, I was applying to Northwestern, and then I got into Northwestern, and he said to me, he was from New York, Brother Jackson, he said, it's great you got in there, kid, but you can't afford to go. How about the Army? So he was just steering me into the Army.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't think I'm going to be suitable for the Army. So, but then it turned out that Northwestern, the financial aid was so good, at least for my family.
Sure, sure.
It was cheaper to go there than St. Lawrence.
Well, that's great.
And it was cheaper than U of I, which was the only other school I applied to.
Northwestern's a weird – my brother went to Northwestern. Northwestern's a weird school in many ways for a – Southside kid from a working class family to attend.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a. I don't know if it was a terrible culture shock for you, but it's there's some adjustments. Yes,
there were huge adjustments. But you know, I was a little unaware of, let's say, the money around me. All I knew was like I got to spend my days reading and listening to smart people talk walking around a nice campus and going into nice buildings.
Yeah.
I felt like I won the lottery, and I never. Questioned, you know, later I was sort of like, oh, all those people on my floor, their parents were all pretty well off.
Yeah, they drove,
I didn't get it.
They drove nice cars.
A friend of mine from Philadelphia, who's my roommate, one of my best friends, freshman year, used to make fun of me because we'd be walking through campus and I was like, man, I love these woods. These woods are great. But the woods was just like a little stretch of trees off Sheridan Road. But
right,
if you grew up at 65th and
Cicero. It's a lot different. It's a lot different. But you liked it, and you liked the classes.
I loved it.
Yeah, yeah, there are a lot of former reporters teaching some classes.
Yeah, like Eric Zorn was one of my teachers, and he was he was a big influence too, you know.
Yeah. You still are in touch with Eric?
I see him once in a while around because, you know, he plays music and I play a little folk music as
well. And you live near where Eric and Mary do their songs
of good cheer. That's
right. That's right. School of Folk Music.
Yep.
So you enjoyed your time at, you know, I'm going to keep you on for an hour and a half because we're not even getting to the book.
Let's do it.
The book again, ladies and gentlemen, is The Plan of Chicago, A City in Stories by Barry Pierce. We'll get to the book. You get out of Northwestern, and what's the job situation like out there?
I bounced around. I worked briefly for the Southtown Economist, the Daily Southtown.
Sure.
And then I got a job with a raggy magazine in Old Town, actually, called the Real Estate Profile.
Mm-hmm.
And then New Homes, another magazine that dealt with housing and architecture and real estate after that.
Was this at all, the paycheck aside, was this at all satisfying? It couldn't have been what you had imagined your life in journalism to be like.
I thought Hemingway, Sunday real estate section. But but the one great thing about it, which relates to the book, is that I frequently had to write these sort of neighborhood profiles where I just go sink into a neighborhood, a little like Sidewalks, which you used to do with Osgood. And I would just sink into a place. And I made those bigger and bigger as I became the editor at both of those publications. And those were originally like half a page kind of stories, you know.
Sure.
I eventually turned them into like 4 and 5 page spreads just because that's what I love to do.
Yeah.
And I teamed up with a photographer, again, much like Sidewalks. I teamed up with this photographer who shot the cover photo, Joff Davis, who's an amazing, amazing photographer here. And we would just spend days, you know, traipsing around the neighborhood, eating restaurants, go to the taverns, hear some music.
Talking to people.
Talk to everybody we could, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, and that must have imbued you with the – because it is, in a way, it's like an amazing kind of graduate school to do something like that.
Yeah.
Do you not think?
Absolutely. I mean, I would pay to do that. So
yeah.
I was getting a check to go hang out in a neighborhood. There was nothing better, you know.
And you were – where were you living? Virtually live in different areas around Chicago.
I was back on the Southwest Side for a little while after college. Then I was in Ravenswood. I'm in Lincoln Square now. I was recently in Albany Park for a little bit, but yeah. Back in.
So then you say to yourself, or when does the fiction spark ignite?
It was always there, Rick. Like, you know, through college, starting in high school, I had that bug, and then through college. But just, you know, you have to work, and you're sitting at a desk writing anyway. So you know, to come home and do it again is tough.
That's what a lot of people don't understand, and you do, and I do, is that there is not a switch that you can go that's on nonfiction all day, and then you go home and sit there and have a drink and switch it to fiction,
right.
And then it does not work that
yeah,
way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's tough. And just physically, too, you know, you're just staring
you're
at a
beat.
Screen and
you're yeah.
typing.
Yeah.
And so I did try. I was writing on the side a little bit, but eventually I heard about these MFA programs.
MFA program, sure.
You know, which I hadn't ever heard of.
Which were kind of at that time kind of exploding, were they not?
They were on the upswing then.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we went from having a handful in the country to having a ton of them now.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, that would be a great way to just devote a few years to writing and just go
away. And
you
could afford to do that.
Yeah. You know, if you find the right program, they'll basically pay for it. You know, you'll get tuition and you teach. I taught on the side the whole time I was there. Teaching composition classes.
Did you try to stay here? Did you try to stay in Columbia, for instance?
You know, weirdly, for as big as Chicago was, there wasn't much MFA
yeah.
stuff going
yeah.
at the time. There was Columbia and there was the Art Institute, which was really expensive, I think,
yeah.
and didn't have a lot of financial aid. Northwestern, weirdly, didn't have an MFA. They do now,
yep.
I think.
Yep.
And U of C didn't. So, yeah, I wound up in New Mexico, and I followed Robert Boswell, who's a dear friend and a former teacher. He had taught at Northwestern. I had him as an undergrad. And when he went to New Mexico, I followed him. So
you consider him your sort of a literary mentor.
Yeah,
yes.
He would be the guy. He's the mentor, yeah, for sure.
Is he there now?
He is in Houston. He teaches at Houston now. And he and his wife, Antonia Nelson, another phenomenal writer and huge influence on me, live mostly in Telluride in Colorado. And they teach in Houston. Yeah, part of the year.
Nothing wrong with that. I hate Houston, but there's nothing wrong with that. So when the MFA thing is fascinating to me, what was the nature of the program? Was it to produce a story a week? I mean, they're all every variation is possible in that kind
yeah.
of thing. What was yours?
The typical thing for us would have been two or three stories a semester, really, I think. Because you're in a workshop with maybe a dozen people.
Yeah.
And you just, each week somebody's bringing in a new story and you just rotate around and everybody reads and comments on that person's story or chapter for the week. So, yeah, two or three per semester was more the thing.
And did you find yourself at that time being drawn to the sort of Chicago-centric stories that populate the planet of Chicago?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, the first story I wrote that I felt was Annie Good, and the first story I got published is in that book, Chief O'Neill's it's called, and I pretty much only feel comfortable writing about Chicago. I mean, I've spent some time other places, but most of my life has been here.
Yeah,
so.
But I'm having a great time talking to my new literary hero, Barry Pierce, about his first collection, The Plan of Chicago, A City in Stories. It is that. We have talked about his background, his growing up on the South Side, going to St. Lawrence, winding up with some financial aid at Northwestern, getting out of Northwestern, doing his own version of Sidewalks kind of thing, exploring the city with a photographer and digging a little deeper into many of the neighborhoods, and then going out and seeking masters in
fiction, creative writing, yeah.
Did you have a gift for it? I mean, I'm not talking about what people were telling you. How did you feel about it when you were out there doing this?
I loved it, so there was that.
Mm-hmm.
And I did feel like I was a pretty good writer growing up. You know, I felt like that was the thing I was good at, best at. And then I tried really writing stories and turning them into real writers, yeah. and I just realized how far I had to go. So I did feel like there was something there, but like...
But it needed cultivation?
Needed cultivation and a ton of nurturing work and practice. Work. Nurturing, absolutely, all of that.
Do you remember what your first story where you said to yourself, and I know it's often a struggle... And a lot of rewriting that you said to yourself, okay, this is a good short story.
Well, I think I mentioned this story in there called Chief O'Neill's. And, I think I'd written a number before that in graduate school even, I think. And that was kind of the first one where I felt like it works. I don't know if it's a great story, but it's competent and it works, you know. And I'd written so many things that I just felt like didn't work until then. So that was.
And did that change something in you? Did that change something in the way in which you went about writing fiction?
I think it did. Well, I think it changed my outlook and made me think, because you know you can spend a lot of time thinking this is just impossible, and you're reading all these people, you're reading Chekhov and Alice Munro and Toni Morrison and people like this, and you think. I can never write that well. I might as well give up. And then you write something reasonably good, and you think, okay.
Who were some of your other short story influences? I for one, was wild for a long time about John O'Hara.
Yeah.
And John Cheever.
Yeah, I love both of those guys. And, I mean, unfortunately, sadly, I think, like, names we don't hear much anymore, right? A lot of our listeners probably... They should all go out and buy a John O'Hara book and a John Cheever, the big giant orange collection of Cheever's collected stories. You know, masters.
I didn't know you were talking to the right crowd.
Yeah, okay.
You're talking to the right crowd. Somebody just pulling down a Cheever collection but off their shelf.
In terms of, Chicago writers, Stuart Dybeck, who I know you know and like, was major for me because, you know, he grew up on the Southwest Side. He grew up near me. His experience seemed similar to mine. I was like, I can write about what I'm living through.
When you read Stuart, you can absolutely imagine his character. You can see his characters walking down streets.
Yep.
Not unlike the streets you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So how does a book like this come to be? You do not go back to writing and editing real estate newspapers. When you come back, when you get your degrees.
Yeah, yeah.
And you come back to Chicago?
I came back to Chicago. I did a little bit. I freelanced and then did work for a little while back at actually one of those same publications I talked about. I also taught adjunct. Mm-hmm. So I was teaching cobbling together classes at Loyola and UIC and City Colleges of Chicago. Just trying to make a living, and that's a tough. There are a ton of people here who do that.
Oh, sure,
so it's a really tough way to make rent, you know.
And then you came upon, and after we talk about this short interlude, then we're going to talk only about the book. you came upon the ghostwriting field.
Yeah, I stumbled into that. I guess I did my first one when I was still in graduate school, and a friend of mine, Mike Austin, another great Chicago writer, former wine columnist at the Tribune.
Who plays this strange
drum.
Instrument in
the Bowron.
I know Mike.
Know Mike.
He's a good guy.
Yeah, he's a great guy. One of my good friends. And he did a couple of books through this sort of agency that would set up a quote-unquote author with a ghostwriter. And so I did one for them. And that guy happened to be a kind of consultant who worked for all these companies all over the place. And he set me up with all these clients who wanted books. And so...
And how was that? I mean, I know that, Barry, that it, on some level it had to be quite satisfying because it is writing.
Yeah.
It's also it to be quite frustrating because you're not writing about you.
Right, yeah. I mean...
But it's also paying the bills.
It paid the bills.
It's giving you freedom to...
And I was writing, you know, I have been... with ghostwriting, writing books. So there is something just like the idea that you sit down and you produce these pages and you produce these words and then there's a book at the end of that. And I did that over and over and over. So it made the idea of writing a book seem less daunting and scary.
Do you do it? The process, I don't want to get too into it. The process is you meet someone, you have a conversation, you see if you like one another, you see if you're, the guy's not some neo-Nazi or any attract about killing people or something, and you figure you can do it. How do you then meet in person, or is it phone?
I turned down all the neo-Nazi proposals.
Well,
I've not done one of those.
Well, good for you.
If you hit it off with the person, then it's all just phone interviews. I record and transcribe all our phone interviews, usually once a week, you know, talk for a couple hours, and start cranking out chapters. And really, I have more than half of those books have been business books, and I have no expertise or whatever in business, but, you know.
But it gives you the freedom to then pursue seriously the stories that are in the Plan of Chicago.
And the nice thing about the ghostwriting is schedule-wise, it's in spurts. So, like, you might be on a book for 6 months or 7 months or whatever, and then I usually have a couple of months off where I'm looking for the next project. So I would often have a couple of months to just write fiction, and that really helped me a lot. And
there's a big party soon.
Coming up next Saturday at Martyrs.
Next Saturday?
Yes, next Saturday, 1 o'clock at Martyrs.
Any of you people can go there. You can go and meet the author and
free.
Buy the book.
Yes.
Yeah, it's free. The book is not free, but you can meet the author. So this book is getting so far raves from many of your friends. I mean, let's just be frank, and many of my friends too. When you decide, how do you decide on the number of stories? How do you decide on the number of areas? How did the book coalesce?
There were originally more stories. You know, at first I was just working on stories, and I didn't quite have the book in mind yet and the conceit of it, each story being in a different neighborhood, which is how it works. You know, the stories are all linked, all set in a different neighborhood. Each story gets a label for the neighborhood as well. So there's Lincoln Park and South Shore and Rogers Park. But at some point when I had a big bunch of stories, I realized, you know, each story is set in a different neighborhood, and that would be a way to structure it. There are probably three more stories in a novella that didn't make the cut that I just decided it was A, too big, and B, maybe some of those stories weren't good enough. So I had to excise those. And I did try, Rick, to – I mostly went with just what I thought were the best stories, but I did try to represent the city in some way. There are some north sides. You know, there's some on the south side.
Well, they're all – the other thing, Barry, that really impresses me is there are all sorts of people in here. I know you have had a long-term relationship with a female therapist, but you – I hope she appreciates the fact that you write really well about women. I mean, they're the women – this is not some kind of not some kind of Mickey Spillane collection or Russ McDonald or something. You really do. Do you know that?
Well,
you must have been told that.
Well, I hope so. Yeah, I try. I mean, there are about half the stories are from a woman's point of view and about half are male.
Well, the one that won the very prestigious Nelson Ongren Award that the Tribune gave out, and you won in 2019, is called Shea Whatever, and it begins with black girl walks through Lincoln Park in a blizzard. That's a very catchy, good line, but it is told from the perspective of a young black girl from the South Side, from the
South Shore,
University of Chicago campus area and neighborhood, and her early adulthood love affair with a relatively well-to-do woman on the living in the areas where I used to live. Let's say Halstead and Fullerton.
Yeah, thereabouts.
What happens in this story? I want to hear the author tell me what happens in this story.
Well, I can tell you that, I mean, in a strange way, you know, reading the book, you might think this is the character who's most different from me. She's young, black, gay. I'm old, white, and middle-aged, straight guy. But but in a way, it's the most autobiographical. You know, I had a girlfriend who lived at Halstead and Oakdale, roughly, and there was a fancy restaurant downstairs next to her building, and I was always driving up from the south side in this beater car.
Trying to find a parking space.
Had a different car, trying to find a parking space, always fighting with these valets who would save spaces on the street. And I'd get into it with them, but then you can't leave your car because you know it'll be keyed later. And one day I remember after this, driving through this blizzard, trying to get there, getting out, finally having a parking spot. And as I approached her building outside that restaurant, some guy in a Lexus tossed me his keys. And I caught them and I gave them back and probably gave him an earful. But in my fantasy later, I was like, I should have gotten that car and drove away. It was a gift. He gave me his keys.
It's great. I recognize this fantasy is also one of my own in this thing. When you won, I'm not a big believer in prizes, but when you won the Nelson Algren Award, and I was intimately involved in that because Liz Taylor's my friend, and it was a big deal, and I knew Nelson and all sorts of things, and I had to read a bunch of stories. I don't think it would change your life, but it certainly has to empower you.
Yeah, it was great validation. I mean, I had friends who are successful writers who said, this is it, man. This is your ticket. Like, now agents will be calling you, and it's going to be great. None of that really happened.
Yeah, see, that's the old days.
Yeah, but it was very validating. I thought, not only, you know, did I get paid more money than I've ever been paid for a piece of writing, you know, I've been recognized by this contest that's well known.
Well, it was published in the Tribune. Someone did a mini profile of
you to go
with it. How did it change you? I mean, I know it must have taken a little while to realize that your friends were wrong and you weren't going to get people knocking on your door saying, here's a contract.
I'm not really good. I'm not good at the marketing end of things. I'm not good at trying to sell the stories or anything. And so, but it gave me probably a little burst of getting more serious about trying to send the book out, trying to get an agent again. And that turned out to be a dead end for a long time after the award. But it did give me some motivation to really shape the book and have it out there, you know.
The stories that accompany Shea Whatever, and that's a great title, too, are they of the same vintage? There are some that I sense are older than yesterday.
Yeah, some are older. I mean, like I said, that one, Chief O'Neill's, is pretty old. But, you know, the first version, I worked on it and revised it over many years. Shea Whatever would be one of the newer ones. And that story, Enumerator, that opens the book, I think is probably the newest.
Enumerator. I told Barry during one of our many commercials that Enumerator, which is a roughly 50-page short story, reads to me like a novel. It is about a couple, marry and split up and have kids and try to make their way in the city. I'm going to read if you don't mind. I'm going to read something from this book. Just so you get a sense, and there's stuff in the book that is wildly funny, but here's something that I think and hope will give you a sense of this younger-than-I author sitting here. The Colonel is one of the characters who's kind of in charge of the group of census takers who go out, and here's something from Enumerator. The colonel sent my team to the center of the city. We followed the thickest of the scars on the map along the expressway. Beneath overpasses, we stumbled onto shadowy figures guiding carts stuffed with rags, cans, bedding, and appliances. Some scaled sloping berms to sleep between massive concrete columns or the highway's steel ribs. Like Athena from the head of Zeus, they emerged from the structures as if part of it, born when I shined my light on their huddled forms. Our maps highlighted L routes, drainage canals, and railroad tracks, which, like the expressways, fell between neighborhoods or formed their borders. Why did transients sprout at the city's seams like grass in cracked sidewalks? They liked the shelter of viaducts and trestles and the lack of police in those barren areas, and I realized that whatever particulars they lacked, parent, employment, sobriety, sanity, they lived this life because they did not fit in one box or another. They had straddled borders before becoming homeless and used to the geography of gaps, continued to live in them after. I was so taken with that paragraph, I can't even tell you.
I was really taken with hearing you read it. Rick, I want you to do the audiobook. I'm not kidding.
I'll do it for free.
The best voice on radio, right here.
I'll do it for free. Well, that's, you know, 40 years of smoking and drinking. You too can sound exactly like this. Talk to me about that paragraph. That paragraph cannot come easily. That paragraph cannot just say, oh, okay, another paragraph. I wrote that. That sounds pretty good. That's a worked paragraph, yes?
I labored over it a lot, and it's also the paragraph that not only was written and rewritten probably, but had to come late in the book, that the whole process of the book led to that paragraph.
Yeah, yeah. We have a few extra minutes with Barry Pierce, whose book, The Plan of Chicago, A City in Stories, is just, as we speak, being published. It's available in your finest bookstores. It's available on online places. At Martyrs, a very, very nice club on the north side, he will be there. What time is that thing?
1 o'clock next Saturday.
1 o'clock next Saturday. You can go there. You can have a drink.
Yep.
And you can buy the book, and you can meet Barry. A lot of the book, Barry, is about loss. I mean, there are people. It's not just a woman losing her purse in this chilling story. Lost and Found is a story where two worlds really collide, don't they?
Yeah, they do very much. I mean, a lot of the book is about division, and you know, we mentioned this racial division, class division, ethnic, gender division, you name it, division in terms of violence and gang borders. And but I feel like the city is also full of collisions, you know, these moments of connection.
Yeah.
And that's one of those moments where just this cab driver and a wealthy widow on the Gold Coast kind of have this strange moment of connection. It's not the feel-good romantic comedy of the summer, Rick, this book. But there are moments of, you know, there are glimmers of hope.
It's got a daunting doorman involved. A daunting doorman involved.
No, damn the doorman.
And here's another from Shea Whatever, which is really a great story. We talked about it before. Here's the end of a relationship. In early March, a tidy box of clothes and books appears on the porch in South Shore. Tied up with a string and labeled with her name like a package at Christmas time. A note folded inside asks her not to call again. She smiles bitterly. The only time Dot has been to her home, and she wasn't there. No matter, she tells herself and does her best to brush off this enormous love like a crumb. Easy come, easy go. Plenty more fish in the sea. She has no idea. How could she at 21 that this is a moment when her life permanently changes, that she will never love anyone this deeply again? That's just great writing.
Oh, thanks.
That just great writing. Do you know it? And when you write, and even if it's rewritten and you rewrite something, do you know it? And what do you feel when a sentence... And it may not be that one. That's just one that grabbed me, frankly.
Yeah.
How do you feel when you...
I think often I realize it more in retrospect. I think in the moment I often think things are good, but sometimes they're not.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the next day or the next week I'm like, oh, I thought that was really good. Sometimes I wake up, you know, and you write something down and it turns out it's terrible. But in the moment you're like, ah, genius.
Do you have a routine? I mean, now I feel like I'm interviewing for the Paris Review. What kind of pencils do you use, and what time do you write? When you're writing fiction?
Yeah.
Because I do think it's not going to drive you away from the ghostwritten stuff, but this is going to be empowering in various ways. I think it will be, because I'm not the only one who's going to tell you. How much they like it.
Oh, well, thanks, Rick. I have a terrible routine, and if there are writers listening, like, don't do what I do. I need a long stretch. You know, I just recently was hearing some writer talk about catching 20 minutes here to write and taking a half hour there. And, like, I think Scott Turow wrote his first book on the train South Shore.
Yeah, I know.
From North Shore. I need 6 or 8 hours, preferably 8. And that's a terrible way to write, I think, but it's just what works for me. I can't get into it. you know, the first hour I can't find my seat in the chair, you know,
Sure.
So it takes me a long time to write.
A cup of coffee, I need it.
Yep, exactly.
I think there's a message I should have checked. Yeah.
Yeah, and I do tend to write really slow. I rewrite sentences over and over as I go. And
one obvious question is given in Numerator, and 50-some pages, that's not a novel. It's not even a novella. But is there a novel in you, Barry Pierce?
Yes, there is a novel. Hopefully, I don't know. I have started a novel and have a bunch of pages and a bunch of notes. And so there's a novel about a family with seven kids, much like mine, that comes from Ireland. And it's a family of Irish speakers who wind up in Chicago, three of them born in Ireland, three of them born in here. Born here, one born on the way over on a ship in the 50s. And it goes from there. That's about all I can say at this point.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah. That's okay. I'm going to let you go after reading. I'm going to read something that is the December issue. This is a long read even for me. You want to read this? You want to read this?
The whole thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I think this is really – it's sure. not part of the plan
sure.
of Chicago. This is a bonus for you people out there. This is a bonus. You want to read it or you want me to read it?
Either way, Rick, whatever. Okay. Yep.
Because this is really good. It reminds me of – it is downright Royko-esque. It is about – the Chicago Magazine publishes – some good things and many fine things and some mediocre things, but this is it's part of its package of notable Chicagoans of the year.
Yeah, this is the first time I'm seeing it. By the way, I didn't know. Somehow you stumbled on this, and I didn't know it was here. The homegrown pontiff.
How are you asked? Who asked you to do this? Terry,
Sam, Stanley. Sorry, Stanley. Gosh, I'm drawing a blank on Stanley's last name.
Me too.
Stanley, he's a great guy.
Stanley.
he edited this piece, yeah. And he did a great job editing it, too, I thought.
Well, please, Barry Pierce, read this. This is a bonus for you people. Early Christmas present.
All right. It's called The Homegrown Pontiff, Pope Leo XIV. Like millions around the world, I watched white smoke billow from the Sistine Chapel on May 8th with a mix of bemusement and morbid fascination. I'd watched the movie Conclave a couple of weeks earlier, so my interest in all things papal was piqued. Back in the day, the smoke signal was a genius way to quickly communicate that a conclave had chosen a new pope, the original tweet. In the age of X and Instagram, which the new pope could access from his ever-present Apple Watch, the pomp seemed silly. A televised smoke signal? Why not skip the middleman? My eye-rolling stopped when I heard the new pope's hometown. Chicago? Really? Despite being a Catholic so lapsed, I can lap the other lapsees without breaking a sweat. I found myself giggling like a schoolboy and shaking my head, not in cynicism, but in wonder, maybe even pride, as I heard about Robert, call me Leo, Prevost. Newscasters quickly dug into the Pope Leo's Chicago roots, born in the city, raised in south suburban Dalton, altar boy at St. Mary of the Assumption on the far south side, student at the Catholic Theological Union in Hyde Park. NBC5's Mary Ann Ahern, reporting from Rome, was the first Chicagoan I heard claim a personal connection. She nabbed a quick interview with the future pontiff after his predecessor's conclave 12 years earlier. I didn't know then that Ahern was kicking off an intense game of 6 degrees of Pope Leo. Every work I heard new connections. My buddy John was an altar boy for Father Flack at St. Bede's while he lived in the same house as Father Prevost, probably. Another friend's sister knows three people who knew Prevost when he lived here, three. Another friend was at Von Steuben High School where Leo's mom was a librarian. Does he remember her? Well, no, they didn't overlap, but still. Why were Chicagoans of all stripes, Catholic and non, so eager to claim a connection? One reason, of course, is clout. No city has a better grasp of influence and connections, the potential long-term advantage of knowing a guy who knows a guy. We perfected earthly clout, and now we hope we have the heavenly version on our side. Who knows what the big guy might turn a blind eye to after a word from our homeboy? The purely associative thrill is another obvious factor. A connection to someone important, however tenuous, makes us feel important. This partly explains the flurry of memes making the rounds. Chicago-style Pope featuring Leo as a hot dog, Leo clutching an Italian beef and a bottle of Malort, and my favorite, the SNL superfans in Bears regalia and miters captioned, "Da prayers." Another motive for the memes and source of their humor, though, is the incongruity of it all. Rome, Holy See, Sistine Chapel, Michelangelo, and Bob from Chicago? We're a city of steel, not gold. Crust, not crimson. Jewels, not jewels. Like another Southsider who defied the odds to reach the greatest heights of power, Father Bob was an unlikely candidate, the underdog, and we're all about the underdog. The second city loves the little guy who punches above his weight. I've heard many locals say he's one of us. By this, we mean a Chicagoan, sure, but also an ordinary guy from a working-class neighborhood with grandparents who emigrated from Europe on his dad's side and roots in Black Creole, Louisiana, and the Caribbean on his mom's. What could be more Chicago? Pope Leo, the son of a school teacher and a librarian, gets it, we think. He understands poverty and racism, the strength of diversity, the pain of migration, and the dignity due all work. Of course, a pope from the city of Big Shoulders, the home of the Haymarket Affair and the Pullman Strike, named himself Leo. No city has fought harder for workers' rights, and Father Bob's eponym, Leo XIII, was called the Pope of the Workers because he championed living wages, safe workplaces, and the right to organize during the Second Industrial Revolution. As we teeter on the edge of the Fourth Industrial Revolution and the prospect of artificial intelligence gobbling jobs like a generous alderman, we're comforted by Leo's early rejection of an AI pope that would have, this is for real, granted virtual papal audiences. If there's anybody who should not be represented by an avatar, I would say the pope is high on the list, he told biographer Elise Allen. The infamous hot dog joint on Clark Street, the Wiener Circle, had one of the best claims of a Leo connection posted on its sign shortly after that white smoke appeared. Canes nostros ipse comedit, Latin for he has eaten our dogs. Has he? On a literal level, I can't say, but figuratively, yes, Father Bob has eaten our dogs. He has walked in our shoes. He has smelled the stench of our factories, lived in the shadows of our now shuttered steel mills, seen the scourge of white flight, watched the corruption of our politicians, and, I can almost guarantee, honked for our picketers on strike. He is one of us, unifying Augustine's City of God and the City on the Make, bedfellows less strange than they first seem. A dash of machine savvy will come in handy as Leo rules over the world's largest church, a job that would challenge even Old Man Daly's powers of organization and patronage. Chicagoans, Catholic or otherwise, will watch with pride, confident Leo is looking out for us and ready to dole out the holy clout we might one day need. I can just see Peter greeting us at the pearly gates, removing a cigar in the manner of a wary ward committeeman to warn, we don't want nobody sent. Slyly, we'll look around, lean in, and whisper, Leo.
I literally think that's wonderful. How difficult or easy was that to write for you? That's really a beautiful piece of writing.
I spent a long time on it.
Yeah,
you know,
I'll bet.
Yeah,
I'll
I hadn't
bet.
Written anything else for Chicago, so I wanted to do a good job. And I didn't know if I had the credentials. I thought they should get maybe someone a little more Catholic, but I was happy to do it.
No, so. it's a brilliant piece. Good luck with this. I'm glad to know you.
Thanks, Rick. Likewise, it's been such a pleasure. So great to talk to you.
I'm glad to know you.
Ah.